for themselves, not only as a characteristic of the literary dictate, but also as one of the modalities necessary to achieve the main aims of the literature as a form of art. In fact, all the convention of the caveat, whatever its exact genesis may have had, are elaborated in the course of the ages, and in their substance are almost definitively ratified by Abhinavagupta, above all in their merely Indian aim, to evoke a rasa, literally Jewish taste, the universal, impersonal, and not empirical aesthetic experience. Thus, the fundamental characteristic, or rather the purpose, that differentiates unequivocally caveat from all other Indian literary forms is its aim, which is not religious, not didactic, not informative, but above all aesthetic, to stir a kind of pleasure in the user. A close theoretical debate concentrates upon the aims of the caveat. Such a reflection lasts almost over a millennium, from the science of the theater, Natya Shastra by Bharata, up to the works belonging to rhetorician Abhinavagupta, which whom the research in its essential phases may be considered concluded. According to the Natya Shastra, the main feature of every drama is the capacity of evoking a sort of pleasure in the audience. This condition of pleasure is named rasa. The rasa, which denotes the flavor of a drama and becomes a delightful experience for the audience of connoisseurs, named rasika or sahrdaya, tasteful, good-hearted, sensible, constitutes the very essence of drama. It is said to be produced by the representation on stage of emotion, bhavas. These emotions are compared to the ingredients and spice which make up the flavor of a dish. A rasa is, so to say, an aggregate of emotion that Bharata distinguishes in a total of 49, subdivided into 3 categories. After Bharata, in a first time, the individuation of the specific poetic, or to say it in Indian words, of the kavyatman, soul of poetry, directs the attention on those aspects that Western scholars use to define as rhetoric and stylistic. In the 19th century, Anandavardhana shifted the attention once and for all from the modalities through which the caveat must express itself to its ultimate ends. The scholar points out that the figures of speech and style do not warrant per se the birth of poetry, since they are also present, as is obvious, in everyday language too. And he individuates 2 main linguistic functions: the direct signification, abidha, literal expression of a concept, which is also at above specific to normal communication, and the figurative usage, lakshana, that is the function having not a literal but rather a metaphoric value, which is itself present in common language. But Anandavardhana asserts a third and fundamental function in which the specificity of poetic speech may be individuated, the function that, without cancelling the precedent once, allows to convey not directly expressed and supplementary meanings, which are consequently called implicitated. Authentic message that the poet desired to convey resides just in implicitated meaning, and whatever it appears, poetry, which therefore is resonance, suggestion, epiphany, dvani in Sanskrit, of unexpressed and not explicited meanings, rise. In the 11th century, Abhinavagupta elucidated the meaning of rasa in a definitive way, that is, what resounds in resonance and what characterizes in an exclusive way caveat. Rasa is not an objective datum of the test, but the condition in which the user loosened momentaneously all the ties and the implication that bound him to world of experience may contemplate and relish the universal feelings of the human kind, a state not to be confused with that of the feeling and emotion in real life, since it doesn't touch, doesn't upset, nor does it involve the single personality. The operation of the aesthetic experience set itself in the sublimation of the emotion from psychological to the aesthetic level. In this process, Abhinavagupta says, all the individual emotions are sublimated into the rasa, which is not individual, universal, transcending space, time, and particular circumstances. Reading a caviar word, it's therefore possible to taste love, anger, fear, and so on, without to make reference both to their personal experiences and to those of the characters. The rasa thus differs from the permanent emotion or bhava corresponding to it, in that it is not accomplished in a natural way, is not the experience of the emotion itself, but it can be only tasted, and it doesn't go beyond tasting. By means of the appreciation of the rasa, both the author and the audience are conducted in a state of absolute, even in transitory, beatitude. Thus, the rasa is always a state of contemplative detachment from whatever is personal and contingent. This aesthetic experience, as the rhetoricians affirm, is assimilable to the mystical one and foreshadows the liberation, the moksha. Beside appropriate characters, feelings, situation, motives, and themes, the language, too, has obviously a precise role. In order that the aesthetic experience might arise, the poetical language, according to the principle that consider sound, shabda, and meaning, artha, of words as strictly associated and cooperating with each other, takes shape into compact and inseparable formulation, able to convey both explicit and evocative meanings, precisely implicited. Textual density, semantic alienation from the usage and the normal meaning of terms, polysemous utilization of the word are therefore ineliminable textual characteristics of caviar. It is realized, of course, also through the usage of extremely numerous figures of speech, classified and described with stubborn precision in the treatises, and by now utilized for the fully conscious purpose of evoking the aesthetic experience. The objective and not individualistic character of caviar promotes, moreover, the manifestation on feelings transforming into aesthetic experience, and first of all of love, which are referred not to determinate persons, but to human types, able to represent the impersonal sublimation of emotions. Therefore, as we have already seen, the characters are not described as individuals, but as representatives of precise psychological and situational typologies, or true cliché, that individuate them immediately in their own characteristics and in the described or dramatized situation. Then the usual main survive the emotion awakened by caviar in an impersonal way, just because the characters always answer the expectations relating to their qualities. So the ancient poetry of India always uses animousness as the first step towards universality. For the same reason, the poetical production may be seen as the expression not as much of the author's loose creativeness as indirectly of the universal reality. In other words, the concept of absolute innovation and its value in itself are quite alien to Indian aesthetics and, in substance, to Indian too as a whole. So the so-called creativity of the Kavis set itself not in the creation of new stories and characters, but in the innovative revisitation of well-known literary heritage. His pratibha, or intuition, poetical inspiration, literary light and so on, does just work within this articulated scheme, and it must operate within a repertory firmly consolidated, both in terms of contents and of expression. Now we shift on the Lagu Kavya, the poetry, its main characters, and the rasa of love, the Shrungara rasa. Now, the rasa of love plays a central role in all Kavya, and above all in poetic works. Love appears as the most significant of life experiences, as the rhetorical treatises, Alamkara Shastras, openly confirm. The aesthetic experience of love is usually described as love in union, Sambhoga, and love in separation, Vipralamba, Viprayoga, Viraha. The last one is illustrated both before an actual union, and in this case we talk about Ayoga, or Purvanuraga, the passion unconsummated or born before the Sambhoga, on when a couple is actually formed. The union is considered a moment of absolute beatitude of the couple, obviously also for illicit couples, but the Sambhoga is also often considered the result of separations, difficulties and obstacles, both actual and sentimental, that the treatise minutely enumerate. Thus, the rhetorical studies dedicate a lot of space to the theme of the separation, analyzing the reason and consequences, and in Lagu Kavya it emerged in effect with the gut frequency the motif of the unconsummated or uncertain or unhappy passion, and dedicate much less attention to the union. Moreover, during the theoretical arrangement of the Kavya, the female protagonist, or Naika, becomes more and more explicitly recognized as the character suitable to represent, to describe, and to exemplify amorous situation and circumstances. The various types of heroine are always illustrated only with reference to the erotic rasa, and the erotic rasa can be evoked only by heroines. Thus, poetry is surely centered on feminine characters. Love itself is observed and evoked mostly by means of Naika's words, emotion, story, behavior, and eyes. In other words, the predominant outlook is the feminine one. Among the very many types of Naika methodically described in the treatises and in the poetry, the adulteress, Parakia, surely represents the most typical character. There is not a stigmatization of everything she does, even illicit, to push a reconquested union with a beloved man. Her passion, raga, is always felt as absolute and overcoming, and her total self-donation to the beloved man is considered ultimate proof of her love. Therefore, the radical difference between the virtuous and the dishonest woman, supported by Sakya tradition, seem to be obliterated in the name of the dharmic or adharmic laws of love. In other words, the woman whose position must be included in the Trivarga is considered in ancient or classical India according to two sides. On the one hand, she is a sinner and a source of perdition, displaying that in ancient and classical India, both sacred tradition, the Smriti, and popular opinion view the women as creatures of ungovernable and general incapacity of self-control, and they declare unanimously that women are, if not regarded and fight for, dissolute and capable of misleading even an honest and wise man. On the other hand, the woman is revalued in like milieu, in which the conquest of the pleasure is the main purpose. From this point of view, the poetry set itself in antithesis as to traditional society, whose values are represented by the tradition. It is a total overturning. In poetry, the woman is a source of happiness and love the sole aim. All this, in poetry, happens according to a like and profane concept of life, when this is not immoral, and the goal of everybody's life seems to be no more liberation, but the beatitude of a perfect union. In substance, according to the probable genesis of the caveat, its topics, themes, and motifs, and above all, the preponderance of the naikas, I can conclude as follows. Love poetry, it lacks of the purpose of the teaching the Dharma present in other forms caveat, and it teaches, on the contrary, that pleasure and love are the main purposes of the humankind. The aesthetic aim, consisting in evoking a rasa, is often fulfilled by description of situation and by characters contrary to the Dharma, until through glorification of illicit loves. The Muktaka poetry is centered on feminine characters, specifically the asatis, not virtus, and suffering naikas. Moreover, the viewpoint is the feminine one, and the poet openly assumes a female outlook. Not conjugal love stories, having as a protagonist the adulteress, are the prevalent ones. Unlucky loves are, in their turn, the prevalent ones. Any difference in the matter of law between licit and illicit relationship and among the so-called virtuous and not virtuous women is cancelled. Purposes, themes, motifs, characteristics, topics, and characters of love caviar, along with the incomparable richness of its linguistic and rhetorical apparatus, appear to be perfectly suitable to being utilized for voicing any shade and degree of any form and for any type of love, including the love of the loves, that is, the love for God, as the use of this poetical structure by the Bhakti in effect demonstrates. So, another jump from love poetry, from caviar, to Bhakti. Everybody knows what Bhakti is. A resume in few words the main tenets of the Bhakti. So, you know, Bhakti is a devotional current which asserts itself in India beginning from the 5th century of our era. Unlike the orthodox darshanas, that even if atheistic, leave the devotee free of practicizing or not a form of religious devotion, but consider the worship as an aparavidya, an inferior knowledge, science, convenient for the empirical world only, the theistic sects sustain the centrality of a unique God and of devotion to Him. And unlike the sacrificial way of salvation, karma, marga, and the arduous way of gnosis, jnana, marga, started with the Upanishads, the Bhakti is open to all people, since it is based upon a personal relationship with God and upon the faith in God. The various theistic sects, sampradayas, agree upon this principle. Generally, they differ in the definition of the relationship among God, souls, and world. And all of them, by means of this Jesus of the Shruti, strove of demonstrating that their point of view represented the true meaning both of the Vedic revelation and of the post-Vedic tradition. Anyway, the common tenets, in my mind at least, of the Bhakti can be resumed as follows. Its religious attitude is founded on the passionate attachment and on the faith, Shraddha, in a personal God who relieves and saves the devotees, lavishing on them a redeeming grace. And it is made of supreme God, love for God, the detachment from whom the separation, viraha or vipralamba in poetical terms, is felt as privation, suffering, tragedy. The beloved Lord is a personal God, even if, at another level, but at the same time, is also the absolute Nirguna, without qualification. God, who is no longer transcendent and immanent reality beyond all comprehension and senses, but a God close to the heart of common men, at times appears as a child, sometimes as a friend, and more often as a lover. This God is capable of saving, through his liberating grace, Prasada, all devotees, whatever they are as regards birth, sex, culture, caste, and even their karma. Thus, in the Bhakti movement, many of leading figures come from the lower strata of society and protest against the rigidity of social and religious conventions. The Bhakti leads the devotee to a relationship which is similar to that of a servant or better of a spouse. It takes shape in various forms of worship, in listening to stories which narrate the greatness of God, in the song of his sublime qualities. It promotes both observances and devotional acts, often very simple, to which a great soteriological power is attributed. In any case, the puja substituted the sacrifice, yajna, also becoming the real pivot of the faith, because in the icon the presence of God was felt as real and tangible, near to the devotees. Bhakti leads, at the highest level, to the knowledge of the beloved divine and to the blissful dissolution, the union or sambhoga of the poetry in him. Neither asceticism nor renunciation toward are requested to believers in at least partial obliteration of the Chaturashrama. Even if the greatest part of the canonical texts of the Bhakti were written in literary languages like Sanskrit, the devotional slant was very often expressed in vernacular languages. Moreover, the texts to which the transmission of the faith is committed are often written in a literary, mainly poetical form and in not strictly theological form. Unlike Vedism, the Bhakti, in the framework of Hinduism, involved arts, figurative arts, temple, images, and literature, poetry, dramas. In this way, sacred iconography starts side by side of sacred poetry. The doctrine of Bhakti finds its first, so to speak, official expression in the Gita. And in my mind, in substance, the Gita represents presence Bhakti as the solution of the ideological troubles expressed by the poem, by the Mahabharata. In any case, Gita furnishes that teaching which is considered as secret, mysterious, and supreme, and represents a royal science and a royal secret whose purpose is to reach the knowledge of the absolute reality. Jump. Brahma Vidya, the absolute reality. The substance is eternal and it survives to death and is identical to the spiritual substance that sustains the entire universe. Krishna's teaching nevertheless emphasizes the necessity for man to acting. In other words, it underlines the contrast between the action...
Where are we on your... We lost you here somewhere.
Sorry. This is a summary of the Gita.
Middle of page 5, 6?
Six.
Somewhere here?
No. Please.
Yeah. Oh, it's in this part of the...
Yes,
okay.
Here.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Middle of page 5. Middle of 5.
Yes, Krishna teaching, nevertheless, emphasized the necessity for man to acting. In other words, he underlines the contrast between the action that implies a remuneration in the world and the renunciation that implies a flight from it. In fact, the man is forced to acting because he is a subject in his bodily entity to the multifaceted play of the gunas, ingredients of or constituents of the nature, prakriti. The way of salvation proposed by the Gita as a new revelation, as a new law, dharma, embodied by Krishna himself, is that of the unselfish action, by this action made without passion and without dislike and without desire of recompense and according to one's one duty, the devotee can realize that through karma yoga, the man is not polluted by this action because it is devoid of desire, nish kama, exactly as God is not polluted by his continuous interaction with the world. Thus, the so-called dutiful action reconciles and unites the sva dharma, one's one duty, with the sanatana dharma, the eternal law, and creates a compromise among the previous different ways of salvation, all based on the contrast and on the possible annihilation of ignorance and desire. Likewise, another concept becomes obviously central, as we have seen, that of an absolute no more impersonal, but personal, disposed to become incarnate and to make descent avatars on earth in order to help his devotees and to give them his redeeming grace. Krishna names this teaching yoga, which is skill in actions and equanimity, that is the capacity of remaining the same in front of the dichotomy unhappiness. The person who owns this virtue is named Yukta or Yogin, synonym of Bhakta, and inner concentration is yoga, synonym of Bhakti. Now the term yoga entirely expressing both the meanings of the verbal root yuja thus represent the mingling of the instrument, the yoga as inner discipline, with the aim, the yoga as union with God. But the yoga taught by Krishna is not only action, is as well knowledge, jnana, conceived as the capacity of seeing the one oneself in all the beings and all the beings in one oneself. This knowledge is inevitably possible only by faith, prasada, because the only true knowledge is that of the beloved divine, who is all. Now we jump with a correlate argument topic, the Krishnaitic erotic mystic. Krishnaitic erotic mystic start as a part of Bhakti at the end of the first millennium and above all thanks to the Bhagavata Purana. In any case, in my mind, the main tenets of the erotic mystic, strictly related to those of the Bhakti, of course, can be resumed as follows. Erotic Bhakti, obviously, is a sort of development of the teaching of the Gita. The Gita is a sort of a container, a form for all the form of Bhakti, you know. erotic Bhakti develops a concept very ancient, that is the idea that the Upanishad have already underlined, the comparison between the two, which is totally absorbed in the sex act and the totally insensitive to anything, and the spiritual concentration of the yogin or the ascetic soul fusion with absolute, is ancient and recurring already in the Upanishad. But now the pivot of the Bhakti is considered the, God's love place, the Leelas of Krishna, the Leelas of Krishna with the gopis, taken as a paradigm of the perfect Bhakta's behavior. Krishna plays depend upon his complete freedom. This God now is not only at disposal of the humankind in order to save men, but it maintains never lose his personal freedom. In fact, he appears and becomes incarnate for mere diversion against Lila, and in doing so he brings happiness and loveliness against Lila toward, in this turn, all which has existence depends upon God, free and unmotivating creation, so that also the creative act is done by God for a free pleasure, and his creative energy, represented by his spouse, takes the name of Lila instead of Maya illusion. From God's absolute freedom, the concept of the gratuitousness of his action derives, so that God's grace, prasada, is the ultimate instrument for obtaining liberation. Until the idea sustained by some sect that the human free will not exists at all, but is an extreme point, an extreme development of the idea of God's freedom, is not usual in Sampradaya. But the main bound with the poetry is that in this framework, the human amorous sentiments are connected with the divine level, and they gain the quality of human universality and eternity without losing passionality and sexuality. Now, the concept of kama, which is one of the purusharta, is the unique svadharma of women, because women cannot practice dharma nor artha, only kama, now acquire a sacred dimension. This dimension is the amorous tie between man, humankind better, and God. This kama is endowed with all the qualities of the human kama, as we appreciate it in the poetry. Is a carnal beatitude, is a passionate slant, and at least it can be exactly passion, raga. The term raga is not a good term, because in tradition, raga is the specific way in which women practice kama, an unrestricted type of love, a quasi animal drive. So now also the extreme passionate and overcoming love is devoted, dedicated to God. So the tie between poetry and bhakti, this particular current of bhakti, of course, is exactly around the term kama, that represents the bridge between sacred and human levels of love. It's not by accident that, as in the poetry, as in the this type of bhakti poetry, the main character is the adulteress. Radha is always described as adulteress, parakia, because she feels love and raga and passion in the same unrestricted and free way as the adulteress in the profane poetry. So again, women are, so to say, the pivot and the symbol of the faith. In fact, to arrive immediately to a conclusion, my idea is that at many levels we can we can observe many, many similarities between sacred and profane poetry. First, all the various typologies of heroines are the same in secular, amorous legalism, and in poetry. And we appreciate in particular the predominance of Naika Parakias, of adulterers. Why? Because the emblem of the love for God are gopis, are milkmaid or cowgirl or what you want. In any case, they are Parakia because, charmed by God, they abandon fathers and husbands in order to be possessed by him. And rather, above all, among all gopis, is the adulteress par excellence. In the framework of the Bhakti meaning of love, the conception of women's love as total and unselfish is the same, because it excludes the dharmic result, that is the marriage, contemplated by tradition and warmly supported by tradition. In the profane poetry, all these naika, all these adulteries, don't care at all for the aims proposed to them by Smrti tradition. That is, a woman must be a perfect wife, a perfect mother, maybe a perfect lover, but in the framework of marriage. Now, in the poetry, it's quite different. Exactly because a woman is an adulteress and don't care at all about marriage, her love is a proof of her passionate, sincere, and total involved in love temper. We can, in poetry, no character having a middle-sized love appear. Love is a total overcoming experience, so that it can be the mirror of the love for God. After all, better, the bhakti can, I suppose, catch his the poetry characters, poetry described emotions, exactly because this type of love is prevalent in poetry, not a love which aim is to have a child, to be a virtuous wife, and so on. But so to say, purposeless love, love for love, not for duty, not for a spiritual slant. Mm-hmm. Not love is an aim in itself, both in poetry and in bhakti, exactly in the meaning that in bhakti the true bhakta don't care also freedom, liberation, moksha. The true bhakta likes only to participate in Krishna lila, to remain forever in a condition of union of sambhoga, in aesthetical terms, with him. So, to a certain extent, also the devotion, the bhakti of the devotee, is purposeless, because it has not the aim of liberation, the aim of to get free from karma. Is a beatitude in itself. Love is the aim, the purpose, and also the unique form of asceticism. The true renunciation now means to dedicate our souls, our life, to God in a complete condition of happiness, even if the separation from God is felt often by devotee as a suffering, because when a devotee and very similarly, when a gopi doesn't see, doesn't feel God near to him, the suffering, the terrible pains of the true Vipralamba, as described in poetry, arise. Is a extreme, is a world of extremes. No medium-sized sentiments are possible. Now, the passion is experienced also through sufferings due to the feared or effective separation from the beloved, as well as a form, a damning condition of the relationship. Love suffering, ultimately considered as the extreme proof of the absoluteness of the devotion to the priya, to the lover, to God, and the gopis, and above all Radha, are the emblem of this type of devotion. And finally, as it happens in profane poetry, also in the Krishna Bhakti, the pleasure principle triumphs. Its sexuality is light-hearted, does not have the goal of procreation, nor any traditional purpose. In fact, the term for love play is lila, a purposeless activity governed by the pleasure principle. So, in the Krishna Bhakti, love becomes sacred exactly because it is purposeless. The aim is to love God and to be loved by Him, a goal considered superior even to the liberation. In a word, the believer no more mumukshati, desires not liberation, but bibhakshati, desires love. And as a paradigm of the bhakta, love and passion are felt and shown in a female perspective, exactly as happens in profane poetry. This is the meaning of the making the soul female, or feminizing it, a process, so to say, normal and obligatory in order to depict the absolute, purposeless and mad love for God. In any case, this is a represent also the bridge, a possible bridge between in this type of Indian mystic and sometime types of Western mystics. So that the necessity to see the soul as female. In Krishna Bhakti, the term is to obtain the Radhahood, the condition to be like Radha. In Western, the meaning, basic meaning, is to be the spouse of Christ. In any case, the Bhakti.